both sides.
Case number 10-5213 et al. American Bus Association versus Peter M. Rogoff, Honorable Administrator, Federal Transit Administration et al. Appellants. Mr. Yellen for appellants, Mr. Schweitzer for Appley AMA Inc., Mr. Mastro Marco for Appley UMAA.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Louis Yellen from the Department of Justice. With me today at counsel table is Nancy Ellen Zussman from the Federal Transit Administration and Craig Lawrence from the U.S. Attorney's Office. Your Honors, the District Court's decision here invalidating the Murray Amendment was driven by its conclusion that that amendment trammels the petition clause rights of the plaintiffs. That conclusion was fundamentally in error. On any interpretation, reasonable interpretation of the Murray Amendment, the plaintiffs in this matter have all the rights that they are entitled to under the petition clause, and in fact exercised them during the pendency of this litigation by communicating their views to the Federal Transit Administration. The District Court held, contrary to the uniform precedent of the Supreme Court and this Court, that the petition clause requires not only that.
Fair to say you were a little, I appreciate it wasn't you, but that the government's answers to the district court's questions about how much was covered by the act with respect to the procedures before the agency were at least somewhat ambiguous. Whether or not there could be a hearing, whether or not they could issue a letter, those kind of questions.
It's possible we were less clear than would have been ideal. I think that I would have 2 points, even assuming lack of...
Well, it doesn't matter because we still have a statute in front of us, but it may explain that the court's view which is inconsistent with your view now, that the statute itself barred communications or barred the agency's ability to hold a hearing or any of those sort of things.
There I disagree, Your Honor. Even if there's the lack of clarity that you're suggesting, there was no dispute that the plaintiffs in this case were able to communicate their views, to express their views to the agency. The only potential ambiguity that I think you're pointing to would be whether the agency could respond to
the position now is you could issue a letter, but the letter would say, sorry, we can't help.
No, we could actually rule on a request for an order that has been put in place and deny the order.
Yes, well, that's what I mean.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I was ambiguous, but what I mean is all you could do is deny the order.
Correct. What I was responding to was the letter, the idea that it would be sort of an informal communication.
Oh, no.
We could actually have a formal ruling denying a request for a cease and desist order, which would become, assuming the plaintiffs pursued their administrative appeal, it would become final agency action, which could then be reviewed under the APA in the district court. So yes, that is our view. I would say, Your Honor, whatever ambiguity there may have been below, we were very clear that the administration could evaluate a request for an advisory opinion and could deny an order. So, the court, there were a couple of colloquies where there appeared to be some confusion between counsel and the court, but counsel did come back a number of times and say, no, we could rule on that, we could deny that request.
Even if you couldn't, would that be a petition clause?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. As I was saying before, the fact that the plaintiffs in this case were effectively able to communicate their views to the administration, and nothing in the statute prohibits the plaintiffs from doing that or punishes them for having exercised their right to express their views to the administration, is the beginning and end of the petition clause analysis. Even if there were other problems, potential problems, if Congress had limited the agency's ability to respond to plaintiffs, it would not be a petition clause problem. It could be conceivably an equal protection clause problem. That's one of the claims that the plaintiffs have made. But if there's not a petition clause issue here, that's analyzed only under rational basis review. And as the district court itself determined, this statute would survive rational basis review. So the entirety of the district court's judgment hinged on its determination that the agency was unable to respond, that that inability to respond was a petition clause problem, and that petition clause problem required heightened scrutiny. And so that, it, once you take out the petition clause problem, we're in the realm of rational basis review.
Test theory. Suppose Congress said certain types of applications will be returned to, after they've been read enough to make sure they fit within the category, will be returned to the sender. Is that a violation of the petition clause?
I think it depends, Your Honor. I think that what you've just described is a closer case, and the reason I'm sure. I have no doubt. And the reason why it's a closer case is because it at least now broaches the area where the question of whether or not the plaintiff is actually able to communicate views to the government. The precedent is unambiguous that the government has no obligation to listen or respond. The Supreme Court has repeated that particular phrasing a number of times. This Court has repeated that phrasing in its We the People case. So if the agency, without restriction from Congress, received a petition and immediately threw it into the trash without reading it, that would not be a petition clause problem. But if Congress takes steps to limit the agency's ability to even receive a communication from an individual.
This is like the extraordinary Hustler magazine case.
Precisely, Your Honor.
It is. A district court decision.
I'm sorry?
A district court decision,
but an illustrative one in a number of ways, I suppose. There we actually had a concern that a particular person was unable to communicate views to a government official by action of statute. And that at least is much more in the realm of petition clause concern than we have here. If an agency has no obligation to listen, and if an agency could, you know, take a petition that it receives without even opening it and throw it in the trash, and that doesn't cause a petition clause problem, even, of course, although it might cause other problems.
Well, that, in my hypothetical, the Congress mandates that the agency open the letter
just to determine
and see that it fits within the forbidden category.
Right, and so because your hypothetical is purposely supposed to be troublesome, I think that we couldn't give you a clear answer one way or the other. The best I can say is it would more clearly implicate petition clause concerns to the extent that it interferes with a plaintiff's ability to communicate views. So, for example, if reading a RE line at the top of a letter was sufficient to say, well, I've determined that this is in the forbidden category, and therefore Congress has told me I cannot receive this view and throw it out, then you're closer to the category of Congress, in effect, prohibiting a communication with the government. If, on the other hand, Congress said, read the letter, and then don't act on it, you know, then throw it in the trash, I think that's a different case and probably not problematic under the petition clause. If we're not in the, there are alternative arguments that we made, many layers of arguments for establishing the fact that this isn't a petition clause problem. We first established that regardless of what the agency can do here, there's not a petition clause problem because the government has no obligation to listen or to respond. But we showed also, I believe, that even on the district court's theory that some response is necessary, a response is not only possible here, but would be in the offing once this litigation is completed and the regular administrative process continues. Nothing in the Murray Amendment, which only prohibits the enforcement of the charter rule against the particular regulated entity, nothing in that statute prohibits the agency from adjudicating requests for cease and desist order or adjudicating requests for complaints. you know, as we've said in our brief and as Your Honor suggested a moment ago, the outcome of that is determined. The agency has expressed its view of what the Murray Amendment means and what the Murray Amendment would allow. So it's pretty clear that the administration would not find that there was a violation of the charter rule during the period which is at issue here. Nevertheless, the agency still could respond and will respond to the plaintiff's request. So even on the district court's own theory, it would be possible for the administration to have a response. The only other thing that I would suggest, Your Honor, is that the other arguments that the plaintiffs have made concerning due process and separation of powers are largely subsumed by their arguments concerning the petition clause. They're largely repetitive. To the extent that they're not, we would suggest that the fact that the agency has the full ability to adjudicate the matter, to give a response, and that there would be subsequent review in court under the APA would provide all the redress that's necessary and available under the due process clause. And the plaintiffs have given no argument as to why that would be.
And is even that required? So in Bimetallic, the court pretty famously said that when a legislator acts, there's no more, legislature acts, there's no more due process required. You can petition your legislature and you can elect somebody else, but once legislature makes a substantive decision, that's the end of the matter and there is no due process argument. So is it really necessary to have any of these other proceedings?
I think it's probably not necessary, in fact, Your Honor. If this is assuming the interpretation of the statute that we've provided, if and I think, Your Honor, perhaps the way what you're describing is another way of speaking to Congress's ability to change the substantive law here.
If talking about the procedure, that Bimetallic is on the question whether it's procedural due process. They still have the other arguments that they've made, and they may be rendered in the same way you say. But this particular procedural argument that they have a property right which can't be taken without due process, in Bimetallic, the court said that that process is the legislative process.
And that, I think, would be perfectly.
Still could be adjudication of the, or there still could be a right to adjudication.
Yes, of course,
they,
of course.
In fact, fell substantively within provision.
Exactly. It could be a constitutional right that's been removed, but the procedure is satisfied by what the legislature.
I think that's right. I think that's right. I don't mean to be resisting that. I just think that there are multiple avenues for getting to the same result here, and that's one of them. Your Honors, I have nothing further, and I'd like to reserve the rest for rebuttal.
All right. You can do that.
Thank you.
Let's see. We're going to hear now from the American Bus Association. Correct.
Good morning, Your Honors. Richard Schweitzer for the American Bus Association. The government's argument rests solely on the assertion that the petition clause protects only its expression. And that might be true in the context of a letter to a congressman or an unsolicited petition to a government agency where policy issues are discussed. But in this case, we've got a right established in statute to be free from unfair charter bus competition and a formal.
What's left of that right after the Murray Amendment?
The right exists.
In what sense does it exist?
Well, it exists in the sense, as the district court found, that the charter rule still applies to King County Metro. It just simply can't be enforced for the period of this fiscal year.
In what sense does it apply?
It applies, as the government even argued in their brief on the stay, once this fiscal year is over and the Murray Amendment has run its course, if it's not reconsidered, then ABA or other interested parties can file a complaint for violations of the charter rule that occurred during fiscal year 2010. So it's still there. It exists.
Does your case depend on us finding that there's a right?
If the government actually took that position, it's clearly dropped it, and it's an astonishing reading of the statute. Just to reflect my own notion. It's a reading of the statute that astonishes me.
Well, the alternative is that the Murray Amendment affected a substantive change in the law, and this court.
What's wrong with that?
Look at it. It looks very much as if it did.
Well, there's nothing in the statute that says that they are changing the substantive.
They don't have to say that. Congress, all the time through appropriations acts, changes the law.
Well, it's. There's no congressional finding.
And there was a prohibition on government grantees generally from doing something.
Right.
And then Congress withdrew the prohibition on one of the government grantees. Kind of thing happens every day.
To the extent that they have that authority, they would have to have a compelling reason to exercise that authority for a small group.
Who's they? The they meaning
I'm sorry, Congress.
Why?
Even if it's not a First Amendment issue?
Under the Equal Protection Clause, they still have to have a compelling
even if it's only even if there's no First Amendment interest. I thought you had agreed that if there were not a First Amendment interest, we would be in rational basis land.
I think that's probably correct, but we certainly argue that there's a right to petition issue here as
that's
well.
That's separate from
so right.
Your principal argument is not that you had a right that's been taken away. Your argument is that the right to petition is separate and that's been cut off. Is that right?
That's correct.
So but, why is it that if that's true, why isn't it true that the district court has violated the First Amendment by preventing the petitioners, that is the Kings County, from seeking a congressional statute which gives them a special benefit? The district court banned, said enforcement of this statutory right, which is in their favor, can't be enforced. And doesn't that mean that their First Amendment right to seek to petition Congress for just this thing has been violated?
No, they still have the right to have the charter rule amended generally, but they have to do it under constitutional purposes. And in this case, when you're only applying it to a single transit agency in one locality and affecting the substantive rights of the private charter operators that compete with that transit agency, then you do have an equal protection claim.
I'm sorry. I understood your argument. I didn't see in your brief an argument that alone, tested under rational basis, would render it unconstitutional. Your brief is all about the need to have a higher standard.
That's correct.
That's right. So my question is, what's the First is focused on whether there's a First Amendment interest of some level here.
Yes. There's clearly a right to petition interest here.
So why isn't why hasn't the district court cut off the First Amendment interests of the public of the company that's operating on behalf of the public transit company here?
I can't answer.
Well, let me ask you a different way. So imagine Congress passes a statute that says the EPA, even though it was previously authorized to issue a global warming rule, can no longer issue a global warming rule.
Right.
Does that violate the Sierra Club's right to petition Congress to issue the EPA to issue a global warming rule?
No, because they can still go back to Congress and ask them to change that law or to petition the agency.
Why can't you do that? Why can't you go to Congress and ask them to change the Murray Amendment?
We can. But in this case, you have
we
both.
We can or can't?
We can.
Yeah.
But we also still have 5323D, which is in effect and has been eliminated for this fiscal year for a certain group of petitioners.
That sounds like just Congress deciding who gets benefits and who doesn't, which in the absence of a fundamental interest or suspect classification.
But there is a fundamental
interest. Reviewed under rational basis, which means it passes.
There is a fundamental interest here, and that's the right to petition. The right to petition says that in the context of a formal mechanism of redress, that you have to have an opportunity to present your argument, there has to be meaningful consideration, and there has to be some possibility of a remedy. It's the government's position is basically that if you can file a lawsuit in court, you can go through depositions and motions and a trial, but you're not entitled to a decision under the right to petition.
If Congress had eliminated the charter rule entirely, would there be any constitutional problem?
No. No, because there's no constitutional right to be free from unfair competition. But what they can't do is eliminate the right to vindicate your rights under the charter rule for simply a small class of individuals. It's the First Amendment plus the Fifth Amendment together that gets us to the heightened scrutiny under News America.
So I'm trying to figure out what is the First Amendment issue. I want to keep that separate from the second question. So imagine Congress passed an appropriation bill that said people of the District of Columbia cannot enact barring the District of Columbia from enacting a statute that permits smoking of marijuana. Okay, no money can be spent by the District of Columbia, which is like a government agency for this purpose,
right?
From spending money to enact a statute banning permitting marijuana. Is that and the people of the District of Columbia want to have an initiative pass a statute to permit smoking marijuana? Is that a First Amendment problem?
I don't think it's a First Amendment problem as much as an equal protection problem.
And you think it is an equal protection problem?
Yes. And there'd have to be a compelling state interest there.
So, turning over all my cards, we've already decided this case, and neither of you have cited it. So this is this Marijuana Policy Project versus United States. It's a D.C. Circuit opinion from 2002. It seems to me directly on point here. And in that case, the petitioners made exactly the argument you're making here, which is that violates the First Amendment because they were not permitted to enact a to enact the statute that they wanted. They couldn't, and it violated the petition clause because they weren't allowed to petition because they couldn't get a remedy, which is your argument. And the circuit held that not only does the government not have to reply, which is in the We the People case, but the government can simply say, that is, the Congress can simply say, its agencies, in this particular case, the District of Columbia, cannot do this thing. And I don't see how that's different than here, where the Congress is saying, you can ask the agency till you're blue in the face, but the agency cannot enforce this statute.
Well, that's completely at odds with the Third Circuit's reasoning in Foraker and San Filippo, where they talked about the different levels of First Amendment protection based on whether you have a formal petition or an informal petition.
Well, there was a formal petition, maybe the Third Circuit, but we're in the District of Columbia.
I understand
Circuit,
that.
Right. And there was a formal petition here. They wanted to have a formal initiative process. That is, there's a initiative process like there is in many states to enact changes to the basic law. And the Election Commission said, we can't spend funds on this because we can't give you because the consequence would be a statute which Congress has said we can't have money to adopt.
But there's actually some rational basis for the congressional action. Here there's not. Here all
the question in that case was not about whether there's rational basis. The question was whether there's a First Amendment interest in the first place. And I take it from our previous conversation, you have to first establish that there's a First Amendment interest, right? So why is there a First Amendment interest here and not in the Marijuana Project case?
Because we do have a congressionally established statutory right to invoke the charter rule that's been taken away based on a reasoning that doesn't even have a rational basis. There's no congressional finding for protecting King County Metro. There's no reason established in the congressional
I thought the reason
district
was to make sure people could go to Mariners games. That's rational enough for congressional legislation, isn't it?
And they can still go to those games
well, more easily, more readily.
But even as Judge Rubel found, the statute wasn't even specifically tailored to that end, even assuming that that's the end. It doesn't say that King County Metro has to provide better service or lower fares. In fact, they're charging a premium fare for their service. So it doesn't even meet rational basis scrutiny.
But that's not what Judge Rubel said, though. She said...
She said it barely meets it. Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
I think we have 5 minutes for the second petition.
Thank you, Your Honor. Dan Mastromarco for the United Motor Coach Association. Let me start out, I think, by telling this court, at least in my view, from all the research I've conducted, this is a case that is presenting a unique factual pattern for this court to rule on.
But then you'll have to tell me why it's unique compared to the Marijuana Policy Project case.
Well, then I would appreciate another half an hour.
Do the research, or
I think, Your Honor, that this case is unique because the question is, can the United States Congress, through an appropriation rider, constitutionally deny a complainant the right to petition an agency to enforce a statute against a single entity when there is substantial due process protections that were placed in the agency rulemaking by a negotiated rulemaking that was there?
Loads of cases that say that, this, looking at what agencies can do, that suppose they've had a procedure which does a case-by-case resolution of a particular problem, the agency is normally free to adopt a rule which says applicants in category X all lose, right? Why is this not the same? Your client, at least the distant client behind it, is in category X and it loses.
Well, you know, reserving for a moment the question of whether or not this is substantive legislation or simply a removal of rights, I think if I understand the question correctly, the important point is how we distinguish this case from Smith, from Klein, from We the People. And this is one case where the question in the right to petition is there a distinction, as they say, that there is only an expressive right, only an expressive right, that's it. But there's only one listener that can listen, and it's the FTA. Is there a difference between the muting of a voice and the deafening of ears for purposes of the right to petition? There is no distinction. And in the trilogy of cases that were cited, Smith, Klein, and We the People that this court decided and knows very well, was an association that simply asked for response by agencies and Congress and said, why is the silence so deafening? Why can't I get a response? And this court said, you're not entitled to a response. But the key distinction here is that the FTA is denied the ability to respond.
That doesn't distinguish the marijuana case, because in that case, Congress denied the District of Columbia the ability to make the response. How do you distinguish that?
I would distinguish it with Bill Johnson's case, because I think that case is extremely relevant. If this court were to consider, for example...
By distinguishing that, do you mean we made a mistake in marijuana policy?
I think that's an adjudicatory question. I apologize, I'm not as familiar with the marijuana case as I am with the Bill Johnson case. But the NLRB in the Bill Johnson's case simply said, we are enjoining you from going to the courts in adjudicatory.
That was a case where it was assumed by all that Congress had not exterminated the state court right which they were seeking to enforce. Had Congress done so in the NLRA, the outcome would have been completely different. So there, it was clear, it was completely agreed on all hands. The right still existed. The question was whether the particular firm could use ordinary avenues of government to try to enforce the right.
If we assume that it would be completely different in Bill Johnson's, in a factual pattern that was never advanced in that case, as you assume, I'm not sure that the result would have been different. why is there, I think this fundamental issue is, why is there an impingement on the right to petition in this case? Why? Well, if you read the statute, section 172, it says none of the funds shall be made available to enforce the regulation.
That's how Congress does things routinely. You're a charter, your clients are charter companies, and you compete against some who receive government grants. If you didn't have that competition, you'd make more money. But you have competition from some who receive government grants. You want Congress to hamstring the government grantee in what it does. Congress did for a while and then decided to no longer hamstring the government grantee. Kind of thing is ubiquitous in our economy.
And in my past life, I've actually written some of those pieces of legislation.
Yes.
But I will tell you this.
This line drawing is appropriation bill. It's everywhere.
Well, there's a very important distinction. I mean, let's take a look at the case of Will and Robertson.
We're going to have to look at it very fast because you only have a minute left.
All right. What did Will and Robertson say? What Will and Robertson said was that the Congress knows how to repeal a substantive law. It knows how to change the standard. That in Will, they said that it did change the substantive law because it actually said this statute is a change in the application of the law. TVA uses the most colorful phraseology that I can think of. Implications by cardinal rule that repeals by implication are not favored. Clear and manifest, an affirmative showing of intention to repeal, even greater force when the claim repeal rests solely on Appropriation Act. And I would also recommend to this court Colorado River, which I apologize for not providing earlier, but I found it just yesterday, and it's 424-800. And this deals with an appropriation that took away jurisdiction. Said you can't enforce an adjudicatory proceeding against a particular party. And that court said, while there are statutes clearly defining the jurisdiction of the courts, the force and effect of such provision should not be disturbed by a mere implication flowing from subsequent legislation.
You aren't claiming that there's ambiguity about what this provision means.
Oh, I think that there is ambiguity based upon why we are here today. The government is arguing that this makes an effect to the substantive law. Now, actually, I don't really know, to be honest with you, Judge, what they really mean by that. Because they say, quote, we do not contend the Murray Amendment repealed the Federal Transit Act, but in the same breath they say, quote, we made a change to substantive law. What does that mean?
It means the one charter company can now provide intercity bus transportation.
Well, but it did not disturb the charter service rule.
Right, it carved out an exception to it for one company.
In our view, it did not.
Yeah.
What it said was that they simply can't enforce it. There is a huge distinction here. Could Senator Murray have written this legislation to be constitutional? I suppose if I were on her staff, I might have found a way to do so. But she did not write it in that manner. She said none of the funds shall be used to enforce it. And what is important about that distinction is what weight this opinion on a factual pattern that has not been presented before will bear upon future cases to be decided by this court.
Okay, we have your argument. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Now for the government. Is there any time left? 3.5 minutes.
I just have two brief points. The first,
I hope one of them is that you want to adopt the marijuana policy case.
Indeed, it was going to be preceded by an apology that we failed to cite it for the court. It sounds like it's directly on point. The second point I was going to make just goes to the astonishing view that Judge Williams remarked upon.
Judge Williams' view was astonishing?
Astonishingly accurate.
Not astonishingly accurate for Judge Williams.
Absolutely. We presented a number of alternative arguments in our stay paper, and as we mentioned in our reply brief, we made the argument that there was a change in the substantive law in our stay papers, so this was not a new argument. I'm happy to entertain any other questions from the court.
Okay. Case will be submitted. Thank you. We're going to take a brief recess.